Welcome to Green Connections Radio, where we help you live green, work green, and earn green. I'm John Michelson. We are talking innovation with top leaders and thinkers in energy and sustainability and those who are transforming our world. You benefit from my extensive network of C-level executives, entrepreneurs, artists, authors, government leaders, and journalists, and my many years in the media and Fortune 500 companies. Find us online on greenconnectionsradio.com, iTunes, iHeartRadio, where we come to you from today, TuneIn, Stitcher, and wherever you like to listen to your favorite podcasts. I've actually found us on Spanish networks lately, too, which is very fun. So as Houston, Texas, and other communities in Hurricane Harvey's path begin to recover, we've heard amazing stories in the news about heroic efforts to rescue complete strangers and animals from the floods, some heroes even dying in the process of saving other people. We've also heard stories of reporters chipping in, like I believe it was a CBS reporter who flagged down rescue crews to save a man she saw stranded in his truck and at risk of drowning, or the reporters who carried people to safety themselves. We reporters are trained to be objective, to see all sides of an issue, and to tell the stories with an even keel, not taking sides. But reporters are people, too, and we are thinkers. We analyze what's happening and the research we see, and sometimes, well, there just aren't two sides to an issue. New York Times executive editor Dean Bankay and his leadership team took such a stand in January when they named a new climate editor of the Times, saying in part, quote, "No topic is more vital than climate change," unquote. Yes, venerable gray lady newspaper record took an openly stated position that A, climate change is real, and B, it's the most vital topic, and C, he also stated the connection between rising temperatures and climate change in his announcement. So how do you cover climate change as a bona fide reporter? Our lives and world are at stake as a result of it, so it's kind of tricky. Today we have the very person that Dean Bankay named as climate editor, Hannah Fairfield. Hannah comes to her role as climate editor from a fascinating combination of vantage points, which I can't wait to get into. Briefly stated, she was raised in Alaska, which of course has fossil fuels as its largest export. She has a master's degree in environmental science from Columbia University in my hometown of New York City, and she was graphics editor of the New York Times for several years before taking this climate post. To me, that reflects the importance of using visual tools to help explain the climate change issues. So welcome to Green Connections Radio, Hannah, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. So how do you decide which climate stories to cover?
Well, we are entirely focused on excellent narratives, and it's exciting to be in a position to be able to decide how it is we want to focus the newsroom resources that we have. This year, we've done some really interesting work in the Arctic and Antarctic poles. We've sent reporters to Antarctica to show us how the ice shelves are collapsing and the vulnerable ice sheets that may be collapsing soon and contributing to major sea level rise. And we've also sent reporters to Alaska, my home state, as you mentioned, to show how the permafrost there is thawing rapidly, much more rapidly than climate scientists had ever expected.
Wow. So do all the New York Times climate and environmental stories assume that climate change is real and man-made?
We focus extensively on what climate scientists are reporting. And most climate scientists do indeed show through the data that there is a really strong human influence to a lot of the carbon emission rise that we've seen and a direct relationship between the carbon emission rise and some of the effects that we see, including record temperatures, including droughts and increased frequency and intensity of storms.
So I agree. I've covered the National Climate Assessment and similar issues. So it's out. Obviously, they're all out there. And when 97-98% of scientists agree, it's kind of like if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck, it's a duck, right? But we're in a world where we have an administration that is challenging these thoughts. And there are a lot of people who think that reporters should always give two sides to a story. But if we're assuming, if we're taking the data at face value that climate change is real and a preponderance of it says it's man-made, where do you draw the line?
Well, I think when we're reporting on climate science and those kind of stories, we do tend to focus extensively on the science. When we're focused a little bit more on policy stories, I do think it's very important to be able to show that politically there are many angles to different stories. So I consider each story that we write, individually as its own piece. And the balance that each story requires is different for each story. So what I'm trying to say is that the balance required for a science story is going to be a little bit different than the balance required for a political story.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. So in order to illustrate a point, whether it's a policy or a scientific fact, and you talked about going to Antarctica and telling those stories, for example, how do you find the people to help tell the story? I mean, when I was at 60 Minutes, Don Hewitt used to say casting, 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 and casting, right? So we tell the story through someone's experience, or through the experience of a tribe, or through the experience of a community. How do you find the people to tell the story through?
Again, it's very story specific. So the Antarctica and Arctic pieces that I referred to, we focused very, very closely in on the scientists who were there, who have spent a lot of time researching and understanding and gathering the data and now interpreting and analyzing and building models off of it. But in other stories, we've done a series on climate refugees, for instance. That was one that we did last year. And we really wanted to focus very closely on the people whose lives were being upended by climate effects. And some of them were in China, where the expanding deserts had dried up any possibility of farming. And so there were a lot of people who had lost their land to deserts and had therefore had to move. So that kind of climate refugees, or a group of a fishing village that lived on a lake in Bolivia. The lake dried up, and so they could no longer fish. So that was a really exciting series to be able to work on. And so that we focus on the individuals depending on the story that we really are excited to tell. And sometimes the individuals who are being affected are the ones that are the most important. And sometimes it is the scientists themselves who are there in the field and who are working to tell the stories of how the landscapes are changing dramatically.
Yeah. So I noticed that John Schwartz, for example, has included a couple of people that I've spoken to, actually, including Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, for example, on this. I guess what I'm getting at is, how did you find those families that you just mentioned, the refugees? I mean, is it old-fashioned shoe leather? Is it going into the community and knocking on doors? Is it looking at local newspapers for different stories? I mean, how did you actually identify those individual people?
Our reporters, our climate reporters, went to these very specific places that were undergoing this extreme change. And they went there, they knocked on doors, they lived there for a few weeks, they got to know the families, they really got to be part of the community. I think that's incredibly important. When you're reporting a story that is focused on how climate change is affecting a community, being inside the community is really the most important thing that you can do.
Great. That's exactly what I was getting at. Okay, so that's cool. I love that. That's old-fashioned reporting shoe leather. Absolutely. Another aspect of this, of covering these stories, is that climate change and energy, frankly, affect every aspect of our economy. So, for example, you mentioned policy, we're looking at infrastructure bills coming up. We're looking at transportation bills coming up. And, of course, there's all these consumer products that we buy that could end up in landfills, et cetera. So, and the carbon tax, we can go on and on and on. Where do you cover stories like that? Do you cover the infrastructure bill from the standpoint of how much funding it's giving, for example, for climate resilience planning in communities?
We balance that coverage with that kind of infrastructure coverage with our Washington Bureau, definitely. But the Team Climate itself has several reporters on it who are fully immersed in business and the sort of effects of climate on business and business decisions. And I think that that's a really important part of any team's climate coverage. And of course, we also have reporters who are entirely focused on some of the regulatory agencies within the government. And of course, are keeping very close tabs on what's happening within the budget.
Okay, good. Yeah. And I presume Scott Pruitt's dismantling of environmental regulations. When do you include, speaking of which, articles or references to pieces like Michael Lewis's piece in Vanity Fair about the Department of Energy or the Rolling Stone piece on Scott Pruitt's campaign to remove all environmental protections, regardless of their impact on public health, it seems sometimes. So when do you include those or do you
we
not?
We tend to not report on other reporters' pieces. We have a fantastic media desk that certainly jumps into those conversations. I admire those pieces and I definitely share them widely. But we don't tend to do a reported piece on something that maybe another magazine or another newspaper has done.
Okay, cool. So tell me about a story that you turned down, that somebody pitched to you and you just didn't want to do.
That's an interesting question. I do find that when I get pitches for places, for instance, we have already been, even if they are incredibly exciting. I recently did turn down a pitch for a story that was focused on Greenland, not because the changes that are happening in Greenland are not incredibly important, because of course they are. But not too long ago, we did a very large visual piece where we took a drone out over the ice in Greenland, and we took drone imagery of the melting into these enormous ice rivers. And we did a very interesting, strong visual piece mapping some of that and using the drone imagery. And readers really responded to that piece. And I felt like because of that, we really were able to, in that moment, tell the story about Greenland. And I don't feel like we necessarily need to do that again anytime soon. There's so many places around the globe that are seeing really strong climate effects, and that I would like to find new corners of the world and new stories to be able to tell.
Well, that's a great point. I appreciate that. So that goes to, it's a perfect segue really for my next question, which is how much of your coverage is domestic and how much of it is international? So I mentioned the National Climate Assessment, which John Schwartz also covered on your team. And I interviewed Kathy Jacobs, who is also one of the co-authors of that. She's terrific. So there's so much, for example, in the National Climate Assessment, and it goes into there's you know, how many communities in the United States, right? So one could argue that there are always more stories to tell about virtually anywhere. So how do you decide when is enough? I mean, it sounds like the Greenland piece was quite comprehensive, so I get that. But like in the National Climate Assessment, are you going to do a whole bunch of other stories on different aspects of it, or how is that going to work?
Our team is we have correspondents who are very focused on more domestic issues, and we also have correspondents who are focused on international stories. So we do have an international climate correspondent who travels extensively, and we also have been able to work very closely with other foreign correspondents around the world who are not strictly part of the climate team, but who are very interested in writing climate-oriented stories, and who often jump in and contribute to that kind of coverage. I would say it's a very even split. It's incredibly important to tell the domestic stories within the United States, both what's happening and what we can see in terms of it affecting communities from Louisiana to Alaska. But there's so many stories that need to be told globally that that I do feel like having that balance is incredibly important. And our readers, to be honest, have respond to both national and international stories very evenly. They're widely read both.
That was my next question: was how do your readers respond, and how do you gauge it?
Well, Twitter is a very useful tool. When lots of people are talking about it, you know that you've really made a difference if you're really getting into that day's conversation. But we certainly have many metrics that we look at. I look at really strong engagement. We certainly look at sharing. So in terms of sort of gauging the sort of, you know, largeness of a story, one of the things that I'm really interested in and excited about, obviously, is visual journalism and being able to use the visual tools that we have, photography and videography and data visualization, to be able to really tell some of these important stories in a very sort of multimedia way, and also make them very accessible to people on their phones, because so many of our readers are coming directly to these stories on their mobile devices. And so it's really important to balance that sort of big visual feel with something that is really easy to read and is fully accessible on the phone. And so that's a challenge, and it's also a really fun challenge.
Yes, it forces you to be more creative. And, you know, that goes to the point, to me, the visual helps create an experience of what you're talking about, right? It's not just facts on a page. It actually creates a visceral response. It's why the cliche of a picture is worth 1,000 words. Two quick questions before I let you go. Do you cover the New York Times in terms of having its own resilience plan, or having a carbon footprint of its own?
So far, we have not. That's a very interesting suggestion.
Good. I'm glad I made a good suggestion. So tell me about, we like to ask people in closing a couple questions about careers. And I'm just curious, two quick questions, I think, for you. So tell us about a moment midway through your career when you had to make a critical choice that in retrospect was a turning point, how you made that decision and what you think of it now.
That's a fantastic question. I joined the New York Times in the year 2000 as a graphics editor, and I was there for a decade when I had a really good turning point. I had recently moved to Washington, and I decided to leave the Times to go and be the graphics director at the Washington Post. And it was a very difficult decision because I had been at the Times for 10 years, for nearly my whole career. And it turned out to be a really excellent decision because it allowed me to experience an entirely new newsroom and an entirely new way of operating and of thinking. And it really allowed me to be more creative and allowed me to learn a lot of leadership skills, leading a really fascinating, strong team at the Washington Post. And it also allowed me then, a few years later, to come back to the New York Times with a really interesting, wonderful, rich set of skills. And really, I feel like be able to contribute much more to this newsroom than I have been in since then.
Oh, that's great. I love that story. That's the point. Can I dig into that for a buffet? And in closing, what would you suggest to a woman in mid-career who wants to use her education and her experience to make a difference?
I would say, to sort of follow up on the story that I had just told you, that I think it's really important to do something that scares you. To do something that you feel like you're not quite sure if you can do. And it's about taking risks, definitely. And it's also about making ourselves a little bit uncomfortable in our careers so that we can grow. And I think that is the advice that I was given at that moment in my mid-career. And it's one that I often think about how I'm very happy with the career trajectory that I've had, and it much of it comes down to that moment in time when I feel like I took a pretty big risk. Do something that scares you every single day.
Oh, I love that. That's great. Do something that scares you every single day. So thank you so much, Hannah, for joining us today on Green Connections Radio. Hannah Fairfield of the New York Times, climate editor. We will link to her site from our site as well. So what did you hear Hannah say, and what do you think of the news coverage of climate change? Tweet it to us at Joan Michelson or post it on our Facebook page and like the page while you're there and ask to join our new private Facebook group or email it to us at info@greenconnectionsradio.com. You can also leave it on iTunes with your review. I'm Joan Michelson. Thank you for joining us. See you next time.
Hi, my name is David Goldberg, president of Edge Studio, a voiceover company. We oversee professional narrators and voice actors for sales videos, training videos, telephone pre-recorded systems, commercials, web videos, and all applications requiring voiceover. And in fact, for over 20 years and in over 100 languages, we have been considered the most trusted and the friendliest leader in the voiceover industry. We're a green company with efforts towards sustainability at all of our studio locations. EdgeStudio.com. Sound people who are happy to help.